I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. Florida's economy is built on growth and development. Tourists, of course, are drawn to its tropical beach economy, and still others are drawn further into its marshy and forested interior. It's those resources and natural wonders that have sparked a call to action and founded an environmental movement rivaled by few others elsewhere in the country. Floridians prevented the Cross Florida Barge Canal, invested billions of dollars also in Everglades cleanup, and at the heart of this movement are women who historically were instrumental in getting legislation passed even before they could vote to help preserve the environment. Here to discuss the role of women in Florida's environmental movement is a panel of experts. We're joined by Victoria Chenkel, who is chairwoman of 1,000 Friends of Florida, Jane Healy of the Orlando Sentinel, who won a Pulitzer Prize for her reporting on growth. Also joining us is Leslie Kemp Poole, an adjunct professor of environmental studies at Rollins College. It's a conversation with today's women of the environmental movement in Florida, ahead on Intersection. And I'm joined by Victoria Chenkel, chairwoman of 1,000 Friends of Florida. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be here.
It's great to have you. We're also with Jane Healy of the Orlando Sentinel, who won the Pulitzer Prize for her reporting on growth. Great to have you, Jane.
Yeah, glad to be here.
And also Leslie Kemp Poole, who is adjunct professor of environmental studies at Rollins College. Poole is a PhD candidate at the University of Florida. Her dissertation, Exploring the Role of Women in Florida's Environmental Movement. Welcome, Leslie.
It's a privilege.
We're taping downtown at the Cirrhosis Club in Orlando, and you ladies are about to give a panel discussion, which has been put together by the League of Women Voters, on the role of women in Florida's environmental movement. Leslie, I'd like to start with you, because the story about women in the environmental movement in Florida actually begins right here in Florida, central Florida, with the Audubon of Florida being established in Maitland. What's the story behind that?
There was a great movement at the end of the 18th century, concern about birds and what was happening to their populations, particularly in Florida. And it was driven by women's fashions. It was the thing of the day to have large birds or their plumes in your hats. And so the Audubon movement arose trying to find a way to cope and protect these birds and create legislation. In March 1900, Clara Domerick, who was a wintering resident in Maitland, assembled a group of friends, and they created the Florida Audubon Society to specifically address those issues in Florida.
And so it's been interesting. Florida does have a strong legacy of women's involvement in the environmental movement, particularly with the folks who've got the name Marjorie.
The three Marjories, absolutely. Most people recognize Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, the patron saint of the Everglades. But there's also Marjorie Harris Carr, who helped lead the group that stopped the Cross Florida Barge Canal. And then Marjorie Canaan Rawlings, who wrote about Florida and really opened the nation's eyes to the beauties of its natural wonders.
Why do you think that Florida has this strong core of female activists, writers, people concerned about the environment in Florida?
Well, I think they came to Florida because they loved it. They appreciated the natural surroundings. And when they saw it start to disappear, which it did in wholesale in the 20s as development started, and then really after World War II, they couldn't help but be passionate about it. That's what I've discovered the key among all these women is that they are strong, they use facts, they're passionate about what they see is going on in Florida, and they really won't take no for an answer.
Have you seen women gaining a stronger role as, of course, women society-wise have become more prominent in it? Because originally, you know, there was a very strong male-dominated society, but you've been able to ascertain about this strong role of women.
Well, that's been some of the fun part of my dissertation research is learning that although women didn't have the vote till 1920, they were marching up to Tallahassee and getting a lot of legislation passed that to protect birds and different plants and landscapes. Women created the first state park in Florida. Many people don't realize that. And they found a way around whatever the social structures were of the time to get things done. And they became more and more prominent as the century continued on, leading organizations. And then I think our Vicki Chenkel here is the example of how far women went. in holding jobs and leading bureaucratic agencies.
What was the reaction from men in society in Florida seeing women get so involved in this movement? Were they equal partners in your view?
In the Audubon Society, they tended to be. They worked together, and women tended to be behind the scenes and let the men be the presidents. But I think that when they saw a common force and men couldn't deny, you know, what was happening to Florida forests and landscapes, then they learned to work together.
Victoria Schenkel, what do you see as the role of women in the Florida environmental movement from the position you sit in, being the chair of 1,000 Friends of Florida?
Well, I have to say I'll speak from my previous history as well. I was secretary for the environment under Bob Graham and the number two under Ruben Askew, which is a historic time, I think, in legislation on Florida's environment. There was kind of a funny take on that. I think I discussed this with Leslie. I thought that a lot of people felt it was very convenient to have a woman as secretary at the time. This was a pro-environment time, but legislators had their constituents who wanted permits, and somehow I was less approachable. So I think to some degree being a female made it a little harder. Well, you know, we could call Vicky Chinkel up and try to get some help for you, but you know, she's not that easy to get to.
Why less approachable?
First of all, I wasn't part of the Florida history famous families. I came from California originally. I love Florida. We did come here because we love it. I love the environment in particular. My husband's a biologist. But I wasn't part of the power structure. I came up through a very unusual way through the ranks in the department, and I didn't owe anybody any favors except perhaps the people who appointed me ultimately into the appointed positions. You could argue, of course, that I owed them a great deal. I think women do have an advantage in politics in any kind of situation that that if used properly is very helpful. I think we can be combative without necessarily raising hackles on other sides. I think we are extremely stubborn and persistent, women are. I think we're used to running things in our families and running the gentleman we know without it being too obvious. And I think although we're known as the more emotional sex, I would say we're more data-driven and practical.
Talk about the pressure maybe that you felt in that position as Secretary for the Environment under those governors back in the 70s and 80s.
The pressure I felt was the difficulty of making some decisions. That particular department develops all the rules and regulations for every single pollution source in the state. And whereas you might think it might be really easy to decide between 0.1 parts per billion of one pollutant versus 0.17 parts per billion, these are not clear-cut decisions. And the pressure was always high on both sides. And the pressure to do the right thing in the force of a lot of that is the only pressure I've really felt to my heart.
You know, I wonder from your perspective also if you have an interesting take on what successive Department of Environmental Secretaries have had, Department of Environmental Protection Secretaries have had, I think particularly of Colleen Castile under Jeb Bush.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, I do. I like Colleen a great deal. I think Colleen was more of a manager than an innovator. But on the other hand, you have to consider the administration she worked for. But I would hasten to say that to compare the administration, even under Jeb Bush, of any of the environmental agencies with what we are seeing today in the legislature, there's no comparison. It's the difference between night and day.
You mentioned under your tenure a pro-environment kind of feeling in Tallahassee. I take it you wouldn't say that's the case right now. Would you have said that also under Jeb Bush and Charlie Crist?
Well, I don't know if I would call them pro-environment. I would call them good stewards in the sense that they knew that the citizens of Florida valued their natural resources. They knew they were at the core of our most important values and our history, but also that our economy, whether it's tourism or agriculture, totally depend on it, and we need safe, healthy water to drink and for other purposes. And they understood that. Now, whether they were, you know, as gung-ho about it as some of us would like them to have been, no, of course not.
Jane Healy, What do you see as the tension between the environmental movement in Florida and the desire for growth in the state, and how does that now translate onto the stage today?
Well, I think Governor Scott, not having any background in government and coming from healthcare, the environment and growth are very complex issues, and developers are generally able to take advantage of that because a lot of elected officials don't know anything about it, and a lot of them don't have sophisticated planning staff. So, and the consultants get in there and just run circles around it. I think Scott, my impression is he certainly doesn't understand the environment or growth, how complex it is. He probably didn't look at any history of why we had this law in the first place, is because local officials are really messing everything
up. Talking about the growth management law?
Yeah, turning that back 30 years. I think he didn't bother to have any historical understanding of why we did it the first time, and it was a dangerous mix there because you had Cannon and Herodopoulos, Dean Cannon, the Speaker of the House, who thought the regulation should be more streamlined too, and then you had Mike Herodopoulos, of the President of the Senate, who thought the same thing. So
you're a longtime political watcher. Do you see that as a big change from the more recent governors of Jeb Bush and Charlie Crist?
A huge change,
I think. Beyond that.
Under Jeb Bush, he did not really do a particularly strong DCA secretary. It was somebody from South Florida who really wasn't that familiar with it, which is exactly what developers like. And I think it took Jeb Bush a few years to understand, because he thought he was strengthening the growth laws at one point, and he wrote, well, now we're strengthening them.
He was looking at this
practically thing. If we just tell people how much more it costs to develop in the rural area, then just by that information, they will not develop there, which was totally wrong. We all know that doesn't happen. He was a little naive in that approach, and so the law wasn't strengthened at all. I think Chris was better. He's more moderate. And appointing Tom Pelham, I think he realized, I can just leave this with Pelham, and we're in good hands. And then Pelham, though, became the real a focus for Cannon, because they really hated Pelham. And, in fact, they were saying last year, well, once Pelham's gone, it'll be okay. You know, we're not going to have to mess too much with DCA. It was Pelham, but that wasn't enough for them, because I think they saw a very willing participant with Rick Scott. Now we'll just go further than that, not just Pelham.
Do you think a lot of this stems from what that individual governor's personal view of the Florida environment
and
is?
And practical view. I think they understand politically in Florida the environment's very important. So it's not something you can just ignore and expect to get reelected. That's why you see Democratic and Republican governors really concerned about the Everglades. In the late 80s, after I wrote my first Florida Shame, it was Governor Bob Martinez, a Republican, who also had Pelham as DCA. He's the one who swooped down and saved the Wekiva River, because he understood how important that was to this area and hadn't got as much attention as the Everglades, but it was really important for this area.
You're listening to a special edition of Intersection. We're on the road. We're down at the Cirrhosis Club of Orlando, and we're speaking with Victoria Chenkel, chairwoman of 1,000 Friends of Florida. We're also joined by Jane Healy of the Orlando Sentinel and Leslie Kemp Poole, who's an adjunct professor of environmental studies at Rollins College. We're talking about the role of women in Florida's environmental movement. Tell us what you're thinking about Florida's environment and the role of women. You can go online to the WMFE Facebook and Twitter pages, or you can send an email to intersection@wmfe.org. This is 90.7 WMFE-FM Orlando. I'm Mark Simpson. Leslie Poole, what do you think about the role of women in the Florida environmental movement today? Is it much changed from that historical perspective, from the Marjories and, you know, creating that kind of literary base that really garnered public attention? Are you seeing women play a role more in positions of power, or is it more in shaping the culture?
Well, women certainly are in positions of power, as, you know, we see with Vicki Schenkel's role with 1,000 Friends of Florida. Women have become the heads of the agencies and become heads of organizations. But I still see women as the major grassroots movement. They're the doers and the communicators. They're the ones who act as treasurers and secretaries and write letters to the editor and have feet on the street and stand and hold protest signs when necessary, because, again, they feel a passion. And I think we've also come to learn in the latter half of the last century is that the environment is also an issue of public health and children's health. And I think women embrace that. And we want our children to have clean air and clean water and grow up and be able to walk in the woods at some point in Florida. So I see them as vital to the movement as well.
Do you see that men are not having those cares, or is the image of the hard, tough man not wanting to come out so openly about protecting those essential elements that preserve a family.
That's an interesting argument because historians have been looking at that throughout the centuries of what male-female roles are, and they tend to think men only are interested in, if you can put environment in economic terms, and women more in aesthetic and health terms. I think it's common sense now, which I don't think is happening in Tallahassee too much anymore. But I see in my students at Rollins College a good mix of male and female who are very passionate about the environment and all understand the big issues.
I want to throw to everybody. You know, do you see that Florida's environmental movement is much different than on a national scale? Does Florida still have something unique, and did it have something unique? What did you see as the way things have unfolded in terms of comparing Florida to other states across the country?
I think it's very unique. First of all, it's such a sensitive environment because it's a peninsula. So you have, you know, I think there's more miles of coastline in Florida than any other state, I believe, even California. Is that right? And so you have very sensitive environment, not only the coastline, so then you get oil spills and everything else, but interior, the lakes and the rivers and the swamps. And so I see it as much more interested in this than almost all other states. California would probably come pretty close. But
Is Florida still a leader environmentally, or is that changing all of a sudden because
of
what
new
Rick Scott and the legislature
have
done?
I think they were looked to before. Now, there's some states that had stronger laws like Oregon, but Florida's not Oregon, and no one ever expected Florida to have Oregon's laws. That's just a totally different, much more less diverse environmentally and everything else. But I think, I believe Florida was considered a leader on growth laws with the growth plans and a strong DCA. I'm sure that's not going to be the case anymore.
Leslie, from a historical perspective, Florida a leader, do you still see it that way today?
Well, we were the ground zero for many of the biggest environmental battles of the last century, the Audubon birds, the Cross Florida Barge Canal, the first major national public works project stopped by grassroots movements, and continuing with the Everglades today is still a central focus internationally. I think that Florida will continue to stay in the focus. We also have the fourth most biodiversity in all of the United States because of our subtropical nature. So we have a lot more to lose as well. And now we may just simply become the laughingstock. I hope not, but
I think it's interesting you mentioned that fourth category. It always makes me think of Florida as being, you know, among the fourth largest states, and of course so important politically. And there you put us in the ranking of number four with environmental things. Florida always comes in with that way. Victoria Schenkel, what do you think about where Florida has been historically in terms of a leader on environmental laws, regulations, and where we are today? Are we still ahead of the pack?
We were the first state, coastal state, to have a major wetlands law, first state to have a groundwater protection law, one of only two or three states to have a statewide growth management law. We had the first major cleanup program. But what we had, which I think was the crown of them all, was the Florida Forever and the land acquisition programs that started with Reuben Askew. And they've been consistently funded. There's always been money for them.
Except
and they
for
were,
recently.
I was getting to that. They're zeroed out. Florida Forever. They also, not only, they play political games with it because they passed a bill for over $300 million potentially to buy Florida Forever lands. And, of course, there was no funding for it. But since there was a bill appropriating them if the funds should become available, the governor vetoed that and counted that as part of his budget-busting veto of the legislature, even though the money never even existed. So Florida Forever was the pride of Florida. We were recognized around the world. For years, our land acquisition totaled more than the entire federal budget for land acquisition, and it's gone.
So what do you think is going to be the next step then carrying forward? Is there going to be enough support to muster to try to find some other way to fund land acquisition, or is funding land acquisition the model that should still stand for today?
Well, I think there are quite a few people working on the potential for a constitutional amendment to have the funding for Florida Forever put back to the way it was originally envisioned. Whether that occurs with the new rules on getting signatures for amendments being made so much more difficult for citizens to take initiatives, I don't know whether that will be possible. And I think it might be time for some marches up to the Capitol like our forebears did that Leslie described, because we have to make them listen.
Would you want to be in the position of being the Secretary for Environmental Protection under Governor Scott?
Governor Scott does not permit his secretary to talk to the press, we would not even be having this conversation. He has to approve every single action in public that the secretaries take. You could imagine someone as talkative as I certainly would not accept a position like that.
And certainly a much different role. I know when I was in Tallahassee, I could practically pick up the phone and get Colleen Castile on whenever we want to talk to her. Jane Healy, I want to ask you, you know, under the session, lawmakers abolished basically the Department of Community Affairs and rolled back the Growth Management Act of 1985. What's going to be the impact going forward of those changes on growth in the state?
Well, it's going to be huge. First of all, the whole basis of this was for more jobs, which is a ruse. I mean, there's no reason you needed this for more jobs to help this economy. I mean, right now there's a million empty residential units. There is a million other lots that have been approved for residential use. So there's no way you would need to roll back the regulations to get to build because the stuff's already approved. And it's not just individual lots. There's half-built subdivisions all over the state. And so what these developers are really trying to do, because they can't get the financing either. I mean, who's in the right minds? If you are going to build, who in the right minds is going to give you financing? For what they're trying to do is get the approvals now to build whenever they want to build, and they'll already have the legal rights to do it, and they will do whatever they want basically then. And who knows, and local governments aren't going to do anything about it.
Was the system working, though, been established? Because developers certainly had raised concerns. There was a lot of frustration in the development community.
Well, yeah, because they didn't get to do whatever they wanted to do. I mean, the idea that—
But, right, you want to ideally have a system that flows from both sides, so was it working?
Well, it did flow from both sides. I mean, I think the only thing wrong with the system then, I think you needed to send everything up to the state because the locals have proven they would not say no. All you did was buy off through campaign contributions now a majority of a city or a county, and you would get it approved. That's why they hated hometown democracy or any sort of vote, because they know it's much harder to get the voters to approve something than just a majority of county commissioners. I think the only thing wrong with the current the system before was that the law didn't do anything to push development to urban areas and where there's lots of land left in urban areas. Now, they did try to do that with Senate Bill 360 a couple years ago, which would mean that you would only have concurrency in the outer areas, not the inner. That's a way to do it. You drive them by economic incentives, but they made the land too big, the urban areas too big, so they're almost like rural areas. But that's what you need to do is to try to push development into the urban areas. And, of course, now no developers are going to the urban areas. The whole economic model for developers to get cheap land and then build a house, and their profit margin is not paying for land. So they're all going to go to the rural areas now. The elected officials are going to like that because there's no residents out there complaining.
Leslie Poole, do you see, as we're looking at this free market approach under Governor Scott, is there a precedent historically for using the free market to determine whether or not land should be acquired and letting the market decide what the value of protecting the environment is?
Well, the free market is kind of what created environmental laws in the first place and led to the conservation movement at the beginning of the last century, because it was clear that the free market wasn't working. Back then, lumber industries would clear-cut timberlands and move on, and they began to realize that this may have been profitable, but it wasn't going to be in the long term. And I think the word sustainability needs to come in here. I think people are starting to understand it. I think young people today understand it and won't stand for it. And maybe what we're seeing are the dark days now, and we'll see some people rise up and counter all this. I think it's pretty outrageous. But I have to add here, the definition of an environmentalist to me is an optimist, and that we believe that things can improve and that we can make them better. And I have full faith that our young people understand that today.
Well, Victoria Chenkel, from your perspective, having such a strong background in state government, do you think Rick Scott's doing the right thing, trying to stimulate some growth in Florida's economy and also give the market a little more free rein?
Well, to add to Jane's numbers, we have 3 billion square feet of approved industrial and commercial space that's already approved, just needs financing and getting built. The way I see it is if we accidentally, on purpose, built even more houses than the 1 million vacant, 1.5 million approved to be built, we'd be diluting the value of Florida homes even more. So he's done the citizens the great favor that not only in this area have we lost, 7 or 8% of the value of our homes over the last year, and South Florida's lost 56%. All we've done actually is taken money away from the citizens of Florida, because we do not need any more houses built in Florida. That's the one thing that's clear. And the other is nobody's going to pay to have them built. So I would say job zero, actually minus jobs, because, of course, he let a lot of people go.
So what do you see as the step moving forward to help protect Florida's environment? Is it just a waiting game? And then what is going to be the effect of waiting for maybe a change in the vision in Tallahassee? Is it going to be too late to repair whatever damage is done?
Well, at the risk of being very rude, I don't think we have to worry too much about Rick Scott. But the legislature is far more frightening, because even though Floridians are very, very supportive of environmental issues, somehow they're electing people to represent them who are not, and who are very much in lockstep, and they're not interested in their local parks and so forth. So it's going to become a political process. We're going to have to find people willing to run who care about the environment. They don't say they care. They do care. They understand the issues. And we'll all have to help educate who's there. And on the young people's side, if I can just take the time to say it, I find young people are very passionate, but they do not participate. They do not vote. They do not work hard. I'm talking as a group, but you need hundreds of thousands of them to vote. You don't need...
Not a collective spirit.
There's not the collective spirit, because they're at home reading everything and getting mad about it, looking at Facebook. They need to be out there and do stuff.
Leslie, you deal with that demographic quite regularly. What's your take?
Well, I'm sure my environmental studies students are the choir, but I see them out there preaching. But I want to say one thing that did happen this spring that I found fascinating was this crazy idea of building golf courses in state parks, and even some talk about shutting down state parks. The reaction was immediate. So there are things that Floridians appreciate and are considered sacred, and I would say that's a signal that if people understand the issue and it's something that they can relate to, they will rise up and make their will known quickly. I think that was a great example. It gave me hope anyway.
Jane Healy?
My concern is there's a lot of damage that can be done in the next 4 years, because, as I said, they're going to get these development rights. And that's what they're going for. That's what they know. If they get it, then they're vested. They have entitlements. And the local governments are stuck with that whenever they decide they want to develop. So it isn't a waiting game. And the developers know exactly that. They all know there's probably a good chance Rick Scott's going to be a one-term governor when you look at his poll ratings now. That will increase the rush in the next 4 years for everybody. And remember, a lot of these are good and ready to go, like at Deseret and Rybalt. They already have the consultants. They already have the plans. They'll rush back in. My concern is, I mean, the locals could stand up to them. I'm not optimistic about local government standing up to them at this point. That's going to be the real battles.
Jane Healy was with the Orlando Sentinel for 35 years. She won the Pulitzer Prize for her writing on growth in the state while she was there. Victoria Chenkel is chairwoman of 1,000 Friends of Florida. And Leslie Kemp-Poole is adjunct professor of environmental studies at Rollins College. Ladies, thank you so much for taking time to sit down with me and talk about Florida's environment.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at the Florida Talks blog. You can visit wmfe.org/intersection to find out more. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.